Support for this podcast and the following message come from Dignity Memorial. When your celebration of life is prepaid today, your family is protected tomorrow. Planning ahead is truly one of the best gifts you can give your family. For additional information, visit dignitymemorial.com.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. As 2022 drew to a close this past December, American music lost a treasure, Anita Pointer. Alongside her sisters, June, Bonnie, and Ruth, she was a founding member of the Pointer Sisters. To mark her passing, we're replaying my conversation with Ruth and Anita from 2014. The Pointer Sisters were and are legends. Few R&B acts from the 1970s made it through to the 1980s, and fewer got stronger. The Pointer Sisters were already music industry veterans when they had their biggest hits in the mid-1980s. Tracks that are ubiquitous even today, like this one from 1982. The Pointer Sisters made it through the disco era and out the other side because they were always brilliant chameleons. They had pop, R&B, and even country hits in the 70s. They even sang straight jazz. This is a cover of the bebop classic Salt Peanuts. And I would be remiss if I did not mention this absolute stone-cold classic from Sesame Street. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Ruth and Anita Pointer join me on the show now. Ruth, Anita, welcome to Bullseye. It's great
Hello.
To have you on the show.
Great to
Hello,
be here.
Hello, thank you.
I have to admit, I was changing from my workout clothes into my work clothes this morning. Wow, I'm So Excited was playing on my stereo here in my office, and I felt like I was in like a really thrilling film montage.
Wow. That's you wanted wonderful. To work out all over again, didn't you?
Yes, absolutely. I was pumped. I was ready to go.
It's a good one.
Wow.
You guys and your sisters and brothers grew up in Oakland.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about what your home was like? Maybe Ruth, you could start. You're the eldest.
Well, it was crowded, I'll tell you that.
Sure was.
I mean, generally, we lived in a two-and-a-half-bedroom house with six kids, and we always had animals, dogs, cats, birds.
And our grandfather.
And my grandfather. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, we didn't feel like it was anything strange at that time because there was a lot of love in our house and a lot of laughter. Mm-hmm.
Both of your folks were ministers, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, they were.
Yeah.
And that made it a little tough, but we got around that. Like Ruth said, it was,
oh, yeah.
They had to leave home sometime and we'd take over.
They couldn't watch all six of us at one time.
As kids, we would try to be ministers, too. You know, I did. Ruth did, too. We'd have little church services downstairs. And mother would shut up all that noise.
And you know, we had to entertain each other because we didn't have a television for the longest time.
Right.
And there was only one real mechanical form of entertainment in the house, a radio that my dad owned. And, I mean, he owned it.
We couldn't
touch
it.
You didn't touch that radio.
You better not touch that radio.
No. And my mom, you know, had one gospel record, Mahalia Jackson, that she pulled out maybe around the holidays that we would play.
When you were kids, popular music was changing really, really fast in really huge ways. I mean, you had the birth of rock and roll in the early to mid-50s, and then you know, 3-5 years later, the birth of soul music. Were you completely insulated from that, or were you feeling that at school and in the world outside your house?
Oh, honey, I was feeling it all. I was feeling it and wanting to be it.
Oh, I'm telling you.
Really. It was like I was sneaking to listen to it, mm-hmm. you know. And it was during the time when, like, the first radio, transistor radio.
Right, the little bitty... Yeah. Dang, those little transistors. I wanted one so bad.
I don't think I ever got one. The first one was big because my brother got one
when
he went off to college. I remember that big cream and pink looking thing he had. Like kids that sit those things up on their shoulders, you
like
know?
The boom box.
Like the boom box. Yeah, right. And I mean, oh my God, the music that you could, you know, you could hear without your parents knowing you were listening to it. Yeah.
Are we talking about a classic, like underneath the sheets at night type situation?
Well, we didn't have one personally to put underneath the sheets. Right. So it was I usually would hear it at another person's house.
Right. Friends' homes, at school.
Friends' homes.
You know, we'd go to our friends and they would be playing everything. So they couldn't
keep
it away
from us. Friends.
What records do you remember really moving you as a kid?
Ooh. Elvis,
Aretha Franklin,
yeah,
Gladys Knight,
yeah, Stevie Wonder, Supremes,
the Motown sound, the Philadelphia sound. You know, all that was just so
James Brown,
popular.
Little Richard,
and I, you know,
Lil Willie John, Sam Cooke, mm-hmm. Eugene Church. Oh my God, Kim Weston. Mm-hmm. Martha Reeves and the Vandellas. It was music that Marvin Gaye. It was music that would just make us cry.
Mm-hmm. It really would.
When did you start singing together?
In church, as little girls, we sang as long as I can remember.
Yeah,
we were singing together, you know, in church. We kind of wanted to, we kind of shook things up at church because we wanted to rock it out a little bit. And and we thought that was cool. But some of the members of the church didn't think so.
Wait, what songs were you rocking out and how are you rocking them out?
Oh, God. What were some of the songs we said? As Jesus sat there on Mount Olive, disciples came to them proudly saying, what shall be the sign of his coming? There's, you know, things like that.
They were gospel songs. They were gospel songs, but our church didn't really embrace, you know, a lively gospel sound.
Right. It was so...
And we had, like I said, we had started going to other people's churches, our girlfriends. You know, we had friends that lived in our neighborhood that fathers pastored other types of churches, and we like to go and visit other churches and go to these other churches and people would be rocking out
with tambourines and things that we didn't even have in our church. We only had piano and organ, and they would have guitars and
drums.
Tambourines and drums and all this.
People would be dancing all up and down the aisles.
The Ephesians Church of God in Christ had a midnight musical.
Please.
And I mean, like Billy Preston would be there. Yeah. Yes!
Yes!
It would be so incredible! Oh my God!
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. We're replaying my 2014 conversation with Ruth and Anita Poynter of the Poynter Sisters. Anita died late last year. She was 74. When did you start performing as the Poynter Sisters yourselves?
In 72, I guess we started our album, and 73, our first album was out.
Well, let's take a listen to the first single from that first album. It's called Yes We Can. It was your first big hit.
Yes.
Now's the time for all good men to get together with one another. We got to iron out our problems and iron out our quarrels and try to live as brothers. And try to find peace within without stepping on one another. And do respect the women of the world. Remember, you all had mothers. I know that we can. I know darn well we can work it out. Yes, we can. I know we can. Yes, we can. Or why can't we? If we want it, yes, we can. I know we can make it work. I know we can make it if we try. Oh, yes, we can. gosh, you're mighty.
Oh, yes, we can. I know we can, can.
What's interesting is, Yes We Can, in a lot of ways, is, a relatively straight R&B record from that era. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a little New Orleansy, a little jazzy.
Mm-hmm. But, Alan Toussaint.
But that album is all over the place stylistically. It's every kind of thing. Was that always the idea?
Yes.
And yep. I mean that as a compliment, not as an insult.
And we were told we couldn't do that. We were told
we didn't want to be pigeonholed.
Can't do that. You got to sing R&B, and that's all you can sing. That's what they told us. And when we brought our first producers, when we brought country music and things like that, they laughed in our face. They just laughed like, "You girls, oh my God,
who do you think you are?
You are black girls, and you have to sing black R&B. That's all you can do." But we showed them.
So I want to play another song from your first record. It's this song called River Boulevard. And this is, and we're going to start with a little bit from the middle of the song. And this is sort of, has a kind of gospel R&B feeling.
Sweet, too. Sweet blossoms.
Sort of by the end of this song, you've gone from, you know, the song starts with a real slow piano build. It goes into that sort of relatively straight gospel R&B thing. And by the end of this song, it is basically full on psychedelic. Let's take a listen to the end. Pretty much. Take a listen.
I don't know, the drums kind of go.
Just Gaylord Burt losing his mind.
I know exactly.
It's spectacular. I love it.
And thank you.
What I think is really interesting about it is that it goes from that crazy outro where everyone's going wild, everyone's soloing at once. It sounds amazing. Directly into this.
Way down up on the Swanee River.
Interesting.
Kind of song to help them push the work along. They hum it to the rhythm of the holy boy. And don't you know the
I mean, that is such a gutsy thing to go from this absolutely most contemporary outre sound directly into Swanee.
Yeah. Mammy, Peppy,
praying for me.
Where did you even get the taste for that music?
God,
we
I don't know.
Always had the taste for that music. Yeah. We loved that whole period. You know, that whole I don't know. We just kind of like had it in our blood. I think.
That harmonizing and, thing that the Andrews Sisters did. That you know, groups did, and we were sort of like a group. We're at home and. We all sang together, so we love that harmony.
You also, at the time, were wearing some absolutely spectacular clothes.
Yeah.
Spectacular clothes.
Yeah. We love those things. Those were our party dresses. And when we got ready to do an album cover, David said, the dresses you guys wear to parties and stuff, that's what I want you to have on. So we didn't have a stylist. We brought our clothes from our closets and...
Yep.
That's how we dressed on our first album cover.
Describe the clothes that you wore back then.
I had on a hat, a stole that Sister Tyers, one of Mother's friends, gave me, and an old suit that we had gotten at an antique store. I love that suit. Oh, my God. I wish I had it now. It was yellow.
Oh, my God.
Oh, and some beautiful satin shoes that I bought in London when we were on the road with Dave Mason. And what did I have on a hat?
There are some serious hats on that album cover, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, Mama's hat on.
You had on, Ruthie had a mother's hat, and Bonnie had on a Sister Tyers hat, and June had on, I think,
June
a Sister
had on
Butler
her own hat.
Most of our clothes came from addicts, and, you know, when they saw that we were really serious about it, mother's friends started giving us stuff. You know, they'd go down in their garages and pull out furs and all this stuff and just gave it to us. It was so wonderful. And then people stole it from us on the road.
Wait a minute.
They did. Yep.
And then all the prices started going up and we couldn't afford it anymore.
I'm telling you. Oh, my God. It's just horrible.
Did you guys know anyone else who was dressed? I mean, you were wearing these beautiful dresses from the 30s and 40s, you know, silk and rayon. And
We had no idea.
Were there other people walking around in Oakland wearing these clothes?
No, you know, I have to say, there was not anybody. I don't remember anybody walking around in Oakland, but I think we can't, I think we were doing that during a period when that was kind of like the trend, because it was during the hippie age when there was so much rebellion going on, you know, that I do remember, especially like tops, antique tops being worn with like bell-bottom jeans and stuff like that.
Then we started being known for just our clothes. And we were really doing too much because we were wanting to change every show, wear a different outfit every show. And we got just run down with that. We were carrying so many things on the road. I mean, our cases would be almost as big as this room. I mean, really, I don't know how we got them on the plane. They were huge, yeah. Big anvil cases, heavy.
And you could carry them on the plane.
I know.
And not get charged.
And then the clothes started tearing up. And then we went on the road with Carol Burnett. And, oh, my God, she taught us so much. Because she took, like, two dresses for the whole tour. It's like a stage play. And that's when I realized, it's a stage play we're doing here. Yeah. We don't have to bring every dress we have. It's not a fashion show, you know.
Right.
But our audience really took it as that. But we started taking less and less things on the road because you can wear them again. You don't have to just, I wore that last week. I can't wear that this week.
You're kidding.
We've got more from my conversation with Ruth and Anita Poynter of the Poynter Sisters still to come. We'll be back after a quick break. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Carvana. With thousands of options under $20,000, plus customizable financing terms and down payments as low as $0 down, it's easy to find a car that fits your lifestyle. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today. Terms and conditions may apply.
If you've never donated to the NPR network before, that's okay. Public radio is available to everyone for free. But we do rely on listener support from those who are able to give. So join the community of supporters for Public Media Giving Days, coming up on May 1st and 2nd. Please give at donate.npr.org, and thank you.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. We're looking back on the life and work of Anita Poynter. She was a founding member of the R&B group, the Poynter Sisters. She passed away at the end of last year. She was 74. Let's get into the rest of my conversation with Anita Poynter and her sister Ruth from 2014.
You had a big country hit in the early to mid-1970s.
Okay.
Yeah, right.
Let's take a listen to this song, Fairy Tale. Anita, I think this is you singing lead, right?
Yes, it is.
From 1974. And my guests are Ruth and Anita of the Poynter Sisters.
I'll pack up all my things and walk away. I don't want to hear another word you have to say. Been waiting for so long,
so
just
long.
Found out there's
something wrong.
Nothing will get better if I stay. There's no need to explain anymore. I tried my best to love you, now I'm walking out the door.
Trying to
never seem to meet me, but I bet you won't.
How did this song even end up getting put out as a single? I mean, how did it end up on your album? How did it end up? Like, you're a recording R&B music. Like, how did you convince your label, like, hey, we've got this country record that we'd like you to pitch to country radio?
David Rubinson loved that song. He loved our writing. And it's a song that we wrote. And he took us to Nashville. He had worked with country musicians before, prior to moving to California. And he took us to Nashville. And we ended up with the Grand Ole Opry musicians playing on it.
Yeah, he really made it authentic. That's what made it acceptable.
And it was, you know, a song that was from the heart. So he really loved it. He really, when he heard it, he was like, oh, my God, I love this. And the band got mad because they didn't want to play country
music.
They didn't want to play it. But, David got it through there.
It was a top 20 pop hit. And you ended up singing it on the Grand Ole Opry.
Yeah.
And I wonder what it was like to sort of step out on that stage that is both the most hallowed place in country music and just one of the world's whitest places.
It was terrifying. It really was. I barely remember the whole event because I was so out of my mind. Even David, after I talked to him later, years later, and he said, you know, when you guys went to Nashville, we had to rush you into the building because there were protesters outside. They didn't want you to be there. They had signs up saying, keep country music country and all this stuff. And I didn't even know. I never saw any of that.
Right.
I never saw it. We went in and we were nervous as hell. And we did our song, and that's when the guy actually honestly did get up in the audience and say, hot damn, them gals is black. Screamed that from the audience.
Yeah.
And so,
like, not accusingly, just revelatory. Like, he just was like, wait a minute, I'm putting it all together now.
Exactly.
There they are.
And then he said, sing it again, honey.
Yep.
So he liked us. He liked us, you know, but it was just such a scary situation.
One thing I remember about the performance was I love the way they don't wait till the end of the song to applaud if they like it. They start clapping right in the middle of the song. You know, and I love that. Just like, we're giving you our approval now before it's over.
I want to play a song from Steppin' from 1975. And this is a song that is one of my mom's all-time favorites. So I would feel I would feel remiss if I didn't play it. And this was one of the last real jazzy sort of early mid-20th century songs that you recorded. It's called Save the Bones for Henry Jones.
Tonight we'll have a party. We'll eat some food that's rare. And at the head of the table, I'll place Brother Henry's chair. Invite all the local big dogs. We'll laugh and talk and eat. But we'll save the bones for Henry Jones, 'cause Henry don't eat no meat.
My mom sings that song around the house when there's a vegetarian coming over to
I love it. That is such a great song. We learned that song as kids.
Yeah.
Our play brother, David Patterson, used to sing that song all the time around. I don't know where he got it from. I don't know.
I don't either.
But he used to sing it to us.
Yeah.
And we just thought that we wanted to sing it. And David thought it was a great idea. And it's, I guess, around the time when a lot of people were becoming vegetarians, too.
I want to play the first single of the second version of the Pointer Sisters. Bonnie left the group for a solo career in the late 70s, 77, 78. Yeah.
76.
In your album from 1977 is a great album, but didn't have any hit records on it, really. And you sort of reformed in a completely different form in 1979. And the first single from that record was a song by Bruce Springsteen called Fire. And this is one of my guests, Anita Pointer, on the lead. We also have Ruth Pointer of the Pointer Sisters on the show right now. Let's take a listen.
I say I don't like it, but you know I'm a liar.
It's a song that he, I read anyway, originally wrote for Elvis Presley.
Really? Well, the demo sounded like Elvis.
I mean, when you hear the song, you can imagine Elvis singing. Elvis actually recorded your song Fairy Tale.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's such a different thing from where you had been 5 years previously. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's such a different thing also from the disco that at the time was still ascendant. And that your sister Bonnie had a couple of disco hits right around the same time. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could tell me about what it was like to sort of tear down your image and rebuild it in a new form.
Well, we kind of felt we needed a new image when Bonnie left. We needed to come up with something different so they wouldn't compare, you know, the two. And Fire was brought to us by Richard Perry. And
he was a producer.
The last
record.
Few years that we recorded. And I listened to it. I said, God, that's too low for me. Maybe I guess he wants Ruthie to sing it. And he said, no, I want you to sing it. So it became our first gold single. We had had gold albums before, but I didn't realize what a difference a gold single made. Because it's a song that's played, that one song, over and over and over and all over the world. Yeah. And it really became a major hit for us and made a total difference in our career.
Yeah.
What were the dynamics like in the group at the time? Because Bonnie had left, and I know June had mental health issues that meant that she was
in and out.
It was
Ruthie
years.
And me, and me, Ruth, and June.
Yeah.
Anita for many, many years. Yeah, like 30 years after Bonnie left.
It was initially, Anita, just going to be you and Ruth, right? And then you sort of brought June back into the fold.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We found Richard Perry, me and Ruth, and he told us, if you can get June back in, we got a deal.
Yeah.
So we went after her because she was upset because Bonnie had left. And, Bonnie's leaving, I'm leaving. And so we talked her into it, and she came and met with Richard. And it was just all beautiful after that because he loved her voice. He loved her, and she was just so vital for us. Oh, my God. It was just the perfect combination, you know. And, yeah.
When it works, it works.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
It's hard for me to imagine being in a group as long as the two of you have, and even less so being in a group with family for that long. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if I think of my mom and her sisters, who are pretty much exactly the same generation as you guys are, and I try and imagine them having been in a music group together. they love each other.
Somebody would be killing the other one.
I'm telling you, it's not easy. And it's not easy.
But
it's the most wonderful thing you could ever have. Because, you know, being out there on that road can be really lonely and depressing and stressful. And to have someone out there you know cares about you from the heart, that makes a difference.
Yeah, somebody that really gets you, really knows you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, knows when to back off,
mm-hmm.
when to come on and say, come on, let's do this. And
knows when I'm
to
feeling
say,
weak,
you don't have
and she'll
to do
come
this.
Over
you
on stage and lift me up. Like our last
literally.
Show. I was very sick in New Year's. And Ruthie saw that I was feeling weak. She came over and just put her arms around me. And we sang like that because I really needed her support. And she just automatically did it, you know, and that's the kind of thing someone will do that loves you. Yeah.
We're taking a break. We'll be back in just a second. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
The Indicator from Planet Money is a daily podcast that helps you make sense of what's happening in the economy. And video games are a growing slice of that economy, with billions of people around the world identifying as gamers. That's why we're dedicating a week-long series to the growing business of video games. Listen to the Indicator for Planet Money podcast on NPR.
From the campaigns to the conventions, from now through Election Day and beyond, the NPR Politics podcast has you covered. As Joe Biden and Donald Trump square off again, we bring you the latest news from the trail and dive deep into each candidate's goals for a second term. Listen to the NPR Politics podcast every weekday.
Okay, zebras, orangutans. Oh,
yes, sorry. Hi.
I'm not used to the animals talking. Who are you?
Yes, my name's Carrie Poppy. I co-host a podcast called Ona, Ross, and Carrie. This is my co-host Ross right here.
Okay.
We investigate spirituality, claims of the paranormal, and we were wondering if we could get on the Ark.
You did come 2x2. I appreciate
that.
Though most of the things I'm letting on the Ark don't talk.
I'm going to be talking all up on this boat. Do you mind boat?
I prefer Ark or
barge. Okay, I'm not listening, but if you let me on, then I will make my really good podcast on your boat.
Can you at least help clean up all the poop?
I guess I don't see why not.
Well, I'll check out the podcast. Where do I find it?
It's on MaximumFun.org.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. We're listening to my 2014 conversation with the Poynter sisters, Ruth and the late Anita Poynter.
How much of a problem was substance use for you guys, especially at the, you know, when the music industry was like just passing bowls of cocaine left and right and,
I'm telling
and
you.
Limousines was also the peak of your careers.
When I moved to L.A., I was shocked. I swear. It's just so prevalent. It was just everywhere, you know, and I just.
This is when? When did you move to L.A.?
79, 74? I think, or it was after the last album with David Rubinson, and then I moved here.
It was it was so prevalent and so around, I mean, even from the late 60s even, you know, seemed like just everybody was doing it, and it was so natural that you just didn't think much of it. You didn't think much of doing it. You didn't think much of the people around you that were doing it. It was there all the time. And I always feel like we were very, very lucky to even have survived through that time because it was everywhere.
Tell me about how you realized that, you know, things needed to change, like when you became aware of it rather than having it just be something that was always around.
I became aware of it when I started getting sick. Mm-hmm. And I was on the road. We were in Atlantic City and I was very sick and I didn't know what was wrong with me. And I went to the hospital. I knew I had a horrible headache that wasn't going away for like days. Mm-hmm. And went to the hospital, and they said, "You have got viral meningitis." And I was like, whoa. So
it scared us.
They threw me in the hospital, and I remember the doctor saying to me, whatever your lifestyle is right now needs to change because your immune system is really beat up. And there was an epidemic. I did learn that was going around in New Jersey of meningitis at that time, where some animals had died and a couple of people even that had the disease. And I caught it because my immune system was just low. Mm-hmm. And I started, you know, reconsidering how I was handling my health, you know, because I'm thinking, why is my immune system low? Basically, because I was not paying any attention to, you know, what I was eating, what I was putting in my body, you know, getting proper rest and all of that. I was just kind of living for the moment and jumping up on stage doing shows and you know, doing coke and smoking weed and drinking a lot of alcohol. And it was crazy.
And Ruth, you had two kids before you were even in the Poynter sisters.
Yeah.
So you had, when this happened to you and you got really sick, you had three kids at home, right? Two teenagers and
I had three children by that time.
Issa was a baby.
Issa was 6 years old, I believe. And that was another, you know, thing that made me think about the way I was living my life was, you know, I felt
your baby.
Like I really could be a better role model for my children, you know, than what I was being, you know.
What was the most difficult thing about getting out of that old life for you, Ruth?
Getting out of it, the most difficult thing was continuing to be around other people socially that didn't seem to have the problem that I did. You know, I always hated being different. Even as a kid, I hated being a preacher's kid because all my friends were doing things that I really wished I could be doing, but my parents didn't allow it. And now here I was, you know, being around people that seemed to be having a lot of fun, you know, drinking and partying and doing stuff. And I couldn't do it because I didn't know how to control myself. I overdid it. And I had to really, really distance myself from a lot of people, even family members. And I moved away and just, you know, started concentrating on trying to be healthy. I went from being a crazy drug addict to being a crazy health nut. Literally. I mean, I made people sick.
She is. She's so strict with her diet. It's just unbelievable. You know, and I saw this around me, and I mean, I had no choice but to stop. It just makes no sense anymore, you know?
Yeah.
So your sister June was in the group with you and was, from what I've read, bipolar. And drug use is really difficult for people with bipolarity to manage because, among other things, everything that's good about using drugs for people who use drugs, all the good feelings that they get out of them are bigger for people who are manic. Mm. And, you know, people also often use drugs to, you know, self-medicate to manage their the mm-hmm. symptoms of bipolarity. And I wonder how the two of you felt having someone who was really struggling with her health in this group with you, especially when you were, you know, when you were doing all the things that a band has to do, you know, mm-hmm. touring and recording and.
Well, that was even harder after Bonnie left because, you know, even the 3 years we were together with all four of us, she was in and out, you know, but we had the three, so it always worked. But, and we never heard of bipolar. I'd never heard that word before.
Right.
You know, and I didn't know exactly what it was that my sister was going through.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand it. And she went to doctors and she said she didn't want to take the prescription drugs and stuff. She said, I don't want to take this stuff. So she wouldn't take it. And I didn't know what to do. I really didn't. We just kept her close, you know, and protected her as much as we could. Mm-hmm. But
this is a scary position
It was a hard time because, you know, like Anita said, the medical technology hadn't kicked in the way it has today, where they have all these diagnoses for mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, there are a lot of things that happened that we had no knowledge about, you know, and it was just very hard. You know, we just had to love her and like, you know, like you said, try to protect her and as much as possible. But she was a grown woman and we couldn't make decisions for her.
Mm-hmm.
Did she ever stop using?
Mm-mm.
I don't think so, no.
No. And in the end, when she had cancer, I didn't, you know, the doctor said she was all through her body, and I think she knew it, and she just didn't want to go through the pain of, you know, chemo and all that crap.
Because I don't see how she was even still standing.
Yeah, I don't know.
Once we saw those x-rays, we were like, whoa. How is she even standing? She's got to be in a lot of pain, but, you know, it was just very, very hard. And she still looked beautiful.
I heard that when she was really at her sickest, she couldn't talk.
No, that's true. She couldn't talk. She couldn't swallow and she couldn't talk.
Mm-hmm.
But you sang to her?
We sang to her, and she would
mouth to us, I love you.
She would smile.
We could always understand when she was saying, I love you,
uh-huh.
You know? So she was surrounded by love up until, you know, right through the last moments of her life.
Your sister, Bonnie, has also had substance abuse issues throughout her life. And the last few years, she's performed with you guys sometimes and often not. Is it tough to know what to do about your, you know, grown sister that you love, that you probably love singing with?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's tough to know what to do.
Yeah, I love her to death. She's just getting out of rehab. And she's doing incredible. She's sober, you know, and I've seen a big change in her. And I'm so happy for her. And I just hope she continues, you know.
But yeah, it's hard to know, you know, mm-hmm. how to deal with it, because you just, it's tough hanging on. The easiest part is getting sober. The hardest part is staying sober. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've really been, you know, I've dealt with the whole issue for a lot of years, even with my two older children. So, you know, one day there's sober, a couple of weeks they're sober, and the next week they're back out again, and you know, and you keep getting your trust violated over and over again to the point where you just don't know, you know, what to believe. So that's the part that makes it very, very difficult. You want to believe in them, you want to trust, and you want them with you, but you know, you have to think about your own life and the issues that you have in your own life too that could be very quickly and very easily taken away.
But how does it feel when you're singing on stage with your sister Bonnie now?
It's like we never stopped.
we haven't sang with her in a while. And
we did some studio work with her in L.A. not too long ago. And it's like we never stopped.
Mm-hmm, it's just
magic.
We
jumped right back into the harmonies that we always knew.
Yeah.
It's magical.
I really miss it.
Well, I really appreciate the two of you taking the time to be on Bullseye. It was really great to talk to you.
You too. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
Ruth and Anita Poynter are of the Poynter Sisters. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, children too.
Ruth and Anita Poynter, the Poynter Sisters, from 2014, one of my favorite interviews in the entire history of this show. Absolute R&B legends, genuine personal favorites of mine since I can remember. Jump was my first favorite song. Anita Poynter will be sorely missed. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. Here in Los Angeles, my producer, Kevin Ferguson, was driving his car when the driver in front of him threw a banana peel out the window. Kevin drove over it and was very glad that Mario Kart is not real. Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Our producers are Jesus Ambrosio and Richard Roby. Our production fellows at Maximum Fun are Tabitha Myers and Brianna Paz. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Our interstitial music is composed and provided to us by DJW, also known as Dan Wally. Our theme song is by The Go Team. It's called Huddle Formation. Our thanks to The Go Team and to Memphis Industries, their label, for sharing it with us. Bullseye is also on YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. Find us there, follow us. We'll share with you all of our interviews. And I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
Every time you drive your car, have a package delivered, or get on a plane, you're polluting the climate. But it doesn't have to be that way.
Nature is powerful. Why don't we use it to our advantage?
Meet the people working on cleaner ways to get around on Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR. Transportation Climate Solutions on Here and Now Anytime, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Across America, history is often recorded on small markers. You've probably seen them on the sides of roads, in front of buildings, in the middle of nowhere. NPR's Laura Sullivan spent a year investigating thousands of markers and found a distorted version of America's history, but also curiosities, humor, and joy. Listen to the new episode of The Sunday Story on the Up First podcast from NPR.
The Indicator from Planet Money is all in on video games. Not just because they're a fun hobby. Video games are one of the fastest growing businesses worldwide, worth more than the film and music industries combined.
We're seeing some games that are really taking, $500 million to make.
We're taking a week-long look at the video game industry. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.